This is where we live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. There was a time when Connecticut was leading the region in clean energy projects. That's not the case today. Coming up, we'll hear from reporter Jan Ellen Spiegel about the state's energy future. A long overdue report on Connecticut's energy strategy is expected to be released soon. We'll find out more later this hour. First, it's a full year into the presidency of Donald Trump, and tonight he addresses Congress in his first State of the Union address. WNPR will bring you the speech live at 9 p.m. with anchored coverage from NPR News. Do you plan on listening or watching his address? What do you want the president to lay out as a priority for 2018? We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Email wherewelive at WNPR.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Presidents often invite guests to their State of the Union address as one way to bring attention to certain policies or issues. Members of Congress, including Connecticut's delegation, have also invited guests tonight from their home districts. A local resident who will be there in person as a guest of Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro is Dr. Suzanne Lagarde. She's CEO of Fairhaven Community Healthcare. Dr. Lagarde, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Tell us about your health center. How long has it been in the Fairhaven community? Who do you serve?
So we've been in Fairhaven, which is a neighborhood in New Haven, for about 48 years. We serve just over 18,000 primarily low to average income individuals, although certainly anyone who wants to seek care from us are welcome. We give a wide range of comprehensive services, all aspects of primary care, from peds to adults, midwifery. We also provide dental and behavioral health services, substance abuse treatment. So a pretty comprehensive package.
You're a federally qualified health center. Explain to our listeners what that means.
So to be a federally qualified health center means that we are recognized by the federal government to achieve certain standards and to serve certain patient populations. Currently, there are about 1,400 health centers across the country. The program was started back in the 1960s under the Lyndon Johnson administration. And in 2017, collectively, health centers served over 27 million residents of the United States.
These health centers you mentioned, including your own, in limbo as you wait to see if Congress will allocate actually billions of dollars to help keep these health centers running. Explain to us how much you get and what is at stake in terms of finding out whether and when you'll be able to get this money.
So the funding we get has been relatively stable for a number of years and is actually divided into two buckets if you think of it fairly simplistically, but 70% of the federal fundings we receive, which is really to help support the care we provide, including to uninsured and to those who are underinsured, that funding has to be reapproved by Congress periodically. It expired on September 30th, 2017. Congress failed to act on it. It wasn't that they voted against it. They just didn't vote on it. HRSA, which is the Division of Health and Human Services that we report directly to, had enough funding to carry us through more or less December. And then there was a continuing resolution in December that gave us additional funding through March 31st. After March 31st, every single health center in this country stands to lose 70% of their current funding. And to give you a little perspective on that, from my organization, that's $2.9 million, which is 14% of our budget. This is staggering sorts of numbers, which will, without question, across the country, impact our ability to provide services. It's estimated that 25% of health centers may have to close their doors. Access to care will be lessened, and patients will have more difficulty in getting the services they need.
I mentioned you're a guest tonight at the State of the Union. Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro invited you. As we noted at the beginning of the show, no one really has any idea what President Trump will talk about tonight. But obviously, Congresswoman DeLauro has spoken with you in recent days about the need for these community health centers. Without these community health centers, where will these people go? What stress will it put on our healthcare system?
So that's a very good question. And, of course, the obvious answer for a large majority of the time will be they'll go to the emergency rooms, which is more costly care, less effective care. The hospital association in throughout the country are supporting the health centers because they realize that the impact on their emergency rooms will be so large that they too will struggle to keep up. So there's a huge downstream effect. There will be a significant job loss. It's estimated that across the country, over 50,000 people will lose their jobs. In Connecticut, that number is over 500. And we're talking we're talking about a full spectrum of workers, including nurses and doctors.
There's also a question about the Children's Healthcare Insurance Program, or CHIP. Where will that money come from, and will it be renewed? Can you talk a little bit about that?
So that was renewed in the January 9th continuing resolution. CHIP was funded for another 6 years. But the issue here for these kids is health centers are who take care of these kids for the most part. So although the funding for CHIP has been renewed, if the health center funding is not renewed or significantly cut, they're gonna have problems with access like all the rest of our patients.
Do you expect healthcare will come up tonight, Dr. Lagarde?
I sure hope so. There was interesting, I was reading yesterday, there was a poll, and I'm sorry, I don't remember who did the poll, but there was a poll that came out that showed that the number one item that the country wanted the president to address was healthcare. And that it actually eked out jobs, and certainly was more significant than other issues that we know he's likely to address, such as immigration. It was the number one issue.
That was the Politico Morning Consult report, our survey
you're mentioning.
Right,
you're
it was 59% of voters who indicated they want to hear President Trump speak about fixing the healthcare system in his State of the Union address. This is where we live. On the phone with me, Dr. Suzanne Lagarde, CEO of Fairhaven Community Healthcare. You know, so often the people that you're serving are low-income families, and we were just talking about the CHIP program. Again, something that's going on in communities across this nation is the opioid crisis. What kind of services are you providing people with substance abuse issues?
So we have a very robust substance abuse program. We're actually have two physicians who are boarded in addiction medicine, in addition to other providers who have what's called a data waiver, which allows them to treat patients with opioid addiction with a certain drug called Suboxone. And we also have a full-time substance abuse coordinator. We know that for this patient population, the most important thing is to connect with them where they are, when they're ready, and the care coordinator sort of becomes their best friend and their best resource, and she's a key role in the whole program. And we also partner with another local addiction program called MAS, which is Multicultural Ambulatory Addiction Services, which is literally two blocks down the road from us in Fairhaven. So we have a pretty robust opioid program, and we're always open. Our doors are open all the time to anyone who seeks our services.
We know that Connecticut's also been taking in a lot of people displaced from Puerto Rico after the hurricane. New Haven is one of the cities that has seen a lot of evacuees come to stay with family. Are these the people that you're also helping?
Absolutely. So Fairhaven is physically located in a largely immigrant community, a largely Hispanic community. So we have seen the bulk of the evacuees arriving in the southern Connecticut area. We work very closely with Junta for Progressive Action, which has been identified as the sort of main intake area for arrivals to the New Haven area. And I'd like to point out to you and your listeners that if this funding cliff, we call it a funding cliff, is not addressed, it will affect community health centers in Puerto Rico. So there are 20 community health centers in Puerto Rico who likewise would see 70% of their funding cut, which, as you can well imagine, they're struggling as it is with infrastructure issues, patients without, you know, basic rudimentary needs of their life, and to now be hit with a 70% cut would be catastrophic.
What do you want to hear from the State of the Union address? You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. It's President Trump's first State of the Union after a full year in office. And again, tonight, WNPR will have that address live at 9 p.m. with anchored coverage from NPR News. I wanted to zoom out now to get some perspective on the very important issue of fixing the health care system in this country. Joining us is Mary Agnes Carey, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Mary Agnes, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So we're hearing from one particular group, a woman who leads a community health center here in Connecticut. Obviously, healthcare very important in her community, as well as getting necessary funds to keep these health, federally qualified health centers open. How likely is it the president will even talk about healthcare tonight, Mary Agnes?
Well, it's thought that he won't focus on it. He might move to talking about his successes, for example, with passing the recent tax bill. Infrastructure issues are very, very high on the list. I wouldn't surprise me if he talked about immigration. But if he does talk about health care, the thought is he might talk briefly about the opioid crisis. He might talk about how his tax bill got rid of the individual mandate, this requirement that most Americans have health insurance or pay a fine. And while it's not likely that Congress would return to an effort to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, it wouldn't surprise me if the president mentioned it because it's very, very popular with the Republican base. So health care is definitely not expected to get a lot of airtime tonight.
You mentioned the opioid crisis. We know that late last year, President Trump declared that a public health emergency. I believe it's been extended recently, but it was a declaration. But what happened in terms of the kind of funding that communities needed? Did anything come from that?
Not so much. Even members of the commission are calling it a sham. Some of them are saying it's a lot of talk and not a lot of action because he didn't call it a national emergency declaration. It wasn't that, so the money didn't come. And so I think if the president is going to talk about opioids tonight, he's got to lay out specific plan of action and funding. Money matters everywhere, but especially in Washington. When you have municipalities and states all over the country struggling with this epidemic, which I believe the latest estimate was something like 62,000 deaths a year right now is what's happening with this. If the president does decide to talk about opioids, he has to be extremely specific and move the issue forward because he's gotten so much criticism over his commission and that, you know, and his declaration stopping short. He had a commission that made recommendations. Not many have been enacted, and he is getting a lot of heat for it.
You mentioned the Affordable Care Act. We saw in the last year Republican lawmakers trying and not succeeding to fully repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. There have been reports that Senate Majority Leader McConnell says they're planning to move on from repeal and replace. But let's talk about more about the impact of this repeal of the individual mandate and the effect that has.
That's right. That's going to start in 2019, next year. That the fine element, the amount of the assessment of getting assessing you for a fine is going to go away. So the requirement's still there, but the fine disappears. So that's kind of an oddity. But the thought is, if that is what happens, and that's what's going to happen now, unless it's reversed, the Congressional Budget Office, which is like the official scorekeeper in Washington, predicts that 13 million. More people would lose their coverage at the end of the decade, the 10 years after that's enacted, and premiums would go up at least 10% just due to the elimination of the mandate. So if those things happen, what could occur is if people are not required to buy insurance, you may have the healthiest, the sickest people rather stay in the system. Healthier people decide, if I'm not going to get fined for it, I'm not going to buy it. And what's happening as a result of that is you have some states, like Maryland, for example, that are looking at putting in their own individual mandate. And these tend to be states that are very supportive of the Affordable Care Act, that run their own online marketplace or exchanges where people purchase coverage. So that is one avenue that some states are looking into. But the thought is, from analysts' viewpoint, is that this is not a good thing for the Affordable Care Act. It could cause premiums to spike because if you don't have healthy people balancing the expenses of the sick people, then prices increase. And so advocates of the Affordable Care Act were very upset about this development.
And you see insurers pulling out of the plans that states are offering, like here in Connecticut.
Well, that's happened. That actually happened even before this passed, and that's another thing to watch, is that insurers will stay in a marketplace if they think they can make money. And in some marketplaces, insurers have been very successful in the Affordable Care Act, and others they have not. And so since the online marketplaces, the exchanges, went into place in 2014, along with the subsidies that help people who qualify based on income purchase their coverage, that's where the insurers has been very interesting to watch. Not always, but often, the urban markets tend to have more choices. The rural markets tend to have fewer. And insurers are still picking and choosing marketplaces, and they can even vary within a state, which is fascinating to watch, to see how many insurers are offering insurance here, how many offer there, what are the prices, what are the plan offerings, that kind of thing. It's been a shifting dynamic.
Mary Agnes Carey, Senior Correspondent for Kaiser Health News, thank you for your perspective and analysis. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Also, Dr. Suzanne Lagarde, CEO of Fairhaven Community Health Care. This is a federally qualified community health center in the New Haven area. She's in D.C. as one of the guests of the Connecticut delegation, Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro. Thank you, Dr. Lagarde, for joining us. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. Coming up, we're going to take your calls next. What do you want to hear tonight from the president? Are you planning to watch? Tell us why or why not. 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. No one knows for sure what President Trump will talk about at his first State of the Union address tonight. Listen to the speech live on WNPR at 9 p.m. with anchored coverage from NPR News. Now, news reports have highlighted immigration and infrastructure spending as two topics that Mr. Trump's expected to focus on. What do you want to hear from him? Join the conversation. 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Now, joining us by phone now is Connecticut's U.S. Senator Chris Murphy. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
What do you want to hear from the president tonight?
Well,
where to begin?
Honestly, I have low expectations, but I expect he will talk about the immigration plan that he's sent to Congress. It's a skeleton of a plan, and for many of us, it's woefully insufficient. But to the extent that he's finally realized that we need to have a pathway to citizenship for Dreamers, that's important. I would love for him to talk about, our moral obligation to protect these kids who came here when they were 3 or 4 years old, who are now teenagers or in their 20s, and not just talk about the political deal that he wants to make in order to get his border wall passed. So that would be important to me. I've been working with the Trump administration for a year now on this issue of Buy American, to the extent he's going to make the case for massive increased funding for the Department of Defense. I hope he also talks about the importance of making sure that that money gets spent on American manufacturers. That's definitely a policy proposal that could get bipartisan support. That would be at the top of my wish list.
Let's talk more about immigration. It can be confusing to follow all the developments, especially, I know you're in Washington, but for the rest of us here, I know that the White House has a plan. Then we're also seeing a report about a bipartisan group. The Problem Solvers Caucus has a plan to help these undocumented students be able to stay in this country and work legally. But it's also tied to the border wall funding as well?
Well, the president would like to use these children, they're young adults now, 700,000 all across the country, as a political bargaining chip in order to get funding for his wall. He has apparently asked for about $26 billion. Now, the reason he's doing that is that there is broad public support amongst Republicans and Democrats to give these kids a chance to stay in the country. There is not broad public support for his border wall. In fact, the communities that live along the border have raised the most significant objections. So that's the reason that he has tied the two together. I wish that we did the popular part of immigration reform, which is protecting these dreamers, and set aside the unpopular part of immigration reform, which is the militarization of our border with Mexico, a decision I think we would regret in future generations.
One of the recipients of DACA here in Connecticut is Carolina Bortoletto, also a member of Connecticut Students for a Dream. She's joining us by phone now. Carolina, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
We've talked to you in the past. You're a DACA recipient. How worried about you? How worried about your future are you? When is your status up?
Well, my DACA status expires next year, so 2019. So I have a little bit of time yet. But I know plenty of other people who, you know, they're very worried right now. They already lost their status, or they're going to be losing their status pretty soon. And we've been hearing a lot that, you know, Congress has until March to come up with a solution, but the reality is that they don't really, because every day there's about 120 DACA recipients who lose their status. So the urgency in the community is really now, and we can't really wait until March.
Senator Murphy's on the phone with us. What do you want to see he and his colleagues do in Washington, Carolina?
Well, we want to see, you know, push for the DREAM Act, because that's a solution that, you know, has been brought up, and it's bipartisan. And I know that both Senator Murphy and Senator Blumenthal in Connecticut did vote in favor against ending the shutdown, because it didn't include, you know, a solution on the DREAM Act and immigrant use. So we do appreciate the support of, you know, Senator Murphy here in Connecticut. And more senators need to do the same thing and, you know, stand strong and hold the line, I guess, in the pressure for a solution for immigrant youth.
Carolina, you know as well as anyone that there are members, there are Americans in this country that don't believe that undocumented youth, despite your circumstances, should be in this country. What do you say to them?
Well, I say that, you know, I think 85% of Americans do support something like the DREAM Act to allow immigrant youth to stay here. And, you know, usually when that many people support an issue, Congress is able to act on something and do something about it. But because immigration is such a political issue, they haven't been able, they just haven't acted on the issue. So my message is that, you know, it's time for Congress to listen to the people and find a solution.
Carolina Bortoletto, again, as co-founder of Connecticut Students for a Dream, a DACA recipient. Carolina, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I wanted to go back to Chris Murphy again, Connecticut's U.S. Senator. We were talking about immigration being one of the issues that President Trump may talk about tonight at the State of the Union. Infrastructure as well. What is your response to, we've been hearing about President Trump's plan for infrastructure. He'd promised $1 trillion, but we're hearing more like $200 million. What are some of your cause for concern there?
Well, we had a big forum in Bridgeport just a few days ago talking about the potential for Trump's infrastructure plan in Connecticut. The worry is that he is going to propose a very small amount of federal funding and require that the states and localities pick up the rest. Traditionally, the federal government picks up about 80% of the costs of big infrastructure projects. States and localities pick up 20%. The rumor is the president's going to propose flipping that and having the federal government only put up 20% of the costs and requiring states and localities to put up the other 80%. That's particularly unfair for Connecticut, in part because many people use our roads to get to and from New York and Boston, Washington, D.C. And so to require us to spend all of the money, 80% of the money, to upkeep 84 and 95 and 91 just makes absolutely no sense. So if it's only $200 billion dollars, and the other $800 billion is going to have to be picked up by states like Connecticut, that's not a very good deal, and that's our worry from the Connecticut delegation's perspective.
I've been hearing reports as well that one of the ideas being floated is to pay for these projects, infrastructure projects, is an increase in the federal gasoline tax. That doesn't sound like something that either side of the aisle would support.
Well, they should support it. I've long been a proponent of increasing the federal gas tax. I have a bipartisan proposal to do it with Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee. I mean, we can't live in this fantasy world in which everybody wants to spend more money on infrastructure, but nobody's willing to pay for it. If you just borrow the money, then it's going to be my kids and my grandkids that are going to end up paying the bill. I've been encouraged that President Trump has seemed open to increasing the federal gas tax, because the alternative is to just put it on our credit card. We need hundreds of billions of dollars in infrastructure work just to maintain state of good repair, never mind actually reduce travel times to and from places like New York and Boston. And if anybody has a better way to pay for it, I'm willing to look at it. But the gas tax, which has not been changed since 1993 and is taking in far less money than anybody ever would have predicted, is still the best way in the short run to pay for infrastructure. I hope that's still on the table.
This is Where We Live. Today we're talking about the State of the Union address tonight, infrastructure, immigration, possibly topics that the president will be talking about tonight. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. We're speaking with Connecticut's U.S. Senator Chris Murphy. Joining us now is Doug Houseladen. He's actually New Haven's Director of Transportation. Doug, welcome to the show.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
I'm doing well. Obviously, transportation on your mind. What do you want to hear from the president, and what's your, your perspective on how the money will trickle down if the administration does propose and it goes through this $200 billion, and what that would leave New Haven to come up with?
Well, that certainly is not nearly enough. Our U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has outlined a much more ambitious need for our infrastructure. Again, as Senator Murphy mentioned, just as a state of good repair, we're going to need more than that. I think for New Haven, we're looking a lot at airport investments and FRA investments. And Mayor Harp continually is talking about digital divide and the access to the 21st century economy. I think with the conversation around leveraging private sector, you've seen a lot of P3 public-private partnership opportunities inside the smart city and inside the fiber to the home or gigabit internet space. So I think President Trump is going to find a receptive Mayor Harp with respect to opportunities to leverage private investment in our internet.
If the administration is over-reliant on states coming up with a lot of the money for these projects, how does that bode well for Connecticut, where we have lots of budget issues? The Special Transportation Fund is practically broke. Where will that leave Connecticut municipalities, including New Haven?
Well, it leaves us in a tough spot, and we were in a tough spot before the tonight speech, and we're going to be in a tough spot tomorrow as well. We have to take care of our own Connecticut needs with our Special Transportation Fund drying up. This is just not a way to run a government. And every day we're being forced to make terrible decisions between maintenance and cutting off our space, our nose to spite our face. I think for us, we really would like to see a vision for investment in multimodal transportation, investment in our Hartford Line system, in our Shoreline East system, in our Metro North system. Getting an hour train to New York is extremely important, and it's actually very achievable if we continue to fix our bridges down in Fairfield County.
We're hearing lawmakers again talking about putting up tolls, but again, in a state that needs a lot of cash to deal with deficits, is there enough political will to have tolls to only go towards these very needed transportation projects and not the general fund?
Yeah, as Senator Murphy mentioned, of course we have to raise our gas tax. U.S. Chamber of Commerce said that we should raise it by a quarter on the federal level. That is only going to be a short-term fix, but we need some short-term fixes. I'm proud that the Democrats and led by State Representative Guerrera have introduced another bill to have a vote on tolls, because, of course, that makes sense in the long run to manage our congestion and also to raise revenue streams. These are things that we must do. And as Senator Murphy mentioned, anybody who thinks that you can have a free lunch in this country is sorely mistaken, and their children and grandchildren will be paying for that lunch for years to come.
Doug Houseladen, again, is New Haven's Director of Transportation. Thanks for calling in, Doug.
Thank you.
You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Pat's calling from New Haven. Pat, go ahead.
Yes, I agree with Senator Murphy's discussion about raising the federal gas tax, but I also think Connecticut's behind the curve with other states in the tolls. I mean, every other state around has tolls. They have mail. They have aggressive enforcement for trunk cargo weight, weigh stations, etc. And we don't seem to be doing very much in that regard to support our own infrastructure. So, I mean, I definitely think that should be fast-tracked. And another thing that a lot of states do is they do camera violations for speeding, and Connecticut's been negligent in not moving forward with that technology as well.
Well, Pat, thank you for your call. I know Senator Murphy just has a couple of minutes left. I wanted to go back to you. If you're still there, you mentioned trade. What are some of your ideas in terms of what the administration is putting forth, concerns about ending NAFTA and impact on Connecticut manufacturers, Senator Murphy?
Well, you know, there's no doubt that NAFTA has sucked many jobs away from Connecticut. You just, you know, drive through our urban core and you see the, you know, hulking factories that have shut down because of foreign competition. Now, everybody understands that globalization is inevitable. You know, we're not going to make the kind of things, the low value added products that we made in Connecticut in the future. But these trade agreements were really written without any, you know, viable means of enforcement. The environmental provisions and the labor provisions are routinely violated. So I'm actually supportive of Trump's decision to go back and renegotiate NAFTA. I think at this point it would probably be cataclysmic to pull out of the agreement. But I think he'd have a lot of support, especially on the Democratic side, if he was able to successfully renegotiate some of those provisions.
Before you go, you did sign with colleagues a letter calling for Mr. Trump to use the Buy American standards. Walk us through that letter.
It's just a really simple concept. When we spend money on purchases by the federal government, whether it be steel for bridges or it's jet engines for the military, we should buy things from American companies. And increasingly, the Buy America law, which has been on the books since the 1930s, is being violated. There's been several independent surveys that show that the military in particular, but sometimes the Department of Transportation, is violating the Buy America law and outsourcing to foreign companies. We lose a lot of jobs in Connecticut when that happens, and I've joined together with a bunch of Republicans and Democrats, actually, to push forward legislation, to send a letter you referenced to the president, making sure that if we do spend a lot more money on infrastructure in an infrastructure bill, that money gets spent on U.S. companies. That'll be really good news for Connecticut manufacturers.
Chris Murphy is a U.S. senator from Connecticut. We want to thank you again for calling in, Senator Murphy.
Thanks a lot.
Today we're talking on Where We Live about the upcoming State of the Union address by President Trump. We wanted to hear from you about what you wanted to hear from the president, what issues rise to the top in terms of the agenda that the president will have in 2018. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. On the phone with us now is Edward Ford Jr. He's actually a newly elected Republican member of the Middletown School Board. Ed, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Ed, one of the reasons we wanted to invite you on is we often don't hear your perspective from a young African-American man in the Republican Party. Tell us about your interest and entry into politics, and what do you want to hear from the president tonight?
Well, you know, I first got tuned into politics really in my senior year of high school. I ran for senior class vice president. I went to Middletown High School, and I was able to win the position. And from there, it really opened up my eyes to a whole new perspective of public service, of giving back, of community service and government. And so I wanted to continue that on. I didn't want it to just end there in high school. So, you know, going to college and going to various different universities, I decided to come back and spend some time here in Middletown and devote myself to the people, you know, devote myself to the school system and that I came up through myself. You know, I went through a lot of the different problems and issues that the kids today are still going through. So I believe that I have an insight and a different perspective to provide in that manner. And, you know, I thank God for blessing me to be in this position today.
You're a member of a party, you know, that many support President Trump. His comments aren't always inclusive of minority groups in this country. How do you reconcile that?
Well, I would say that, you know, a lot of the times, of course, there may be things that are said that people, you know, may not expect or may expect, but aren't always ideal and aren't always something that you would want to hear. But nonetheless, whoever the president of the United States is, I sincerely pray for that person because I know that person has the hardest job in the world, and I want the president of the United States to succeed because if that person succeeds, the nation succeeds. And that's something that I believe that every American should want.
What do you want the president to talk about tonight in terms of moving the country forward, including, you know, people in Middletown, Connecticut?
I would like to hear more bipartisan tone. I definitely would like to hear that, because I know that lasting progress happens when people on both sides of the aisle come together to create that progress. And, you know, we see that nowadays there's a lot of more, you know, polarization and division. And what I want to see is more people coming together from different sides of the aisle, working together. I want to see that on the national level. I want to see that on the state level and on the local level.
Edward Ford Jr. Is a Middletown, Connecticut resident, a newly elected Republican member of the school board there. Ed, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchar. We're going to take a break from the State of the Union address again tonight at 9. Instead, we're going to, after the break, focus on clean energy. Reporter Jan Ellen Spiegel with the Connecticut Mirror just wrote an in-depth piece on where Connecticut stands on clean energy. It may surprise you. That's after the break. Coming up Thursday on Where We Live, Catherine Smith is Commissioner of Connecticut's Department of Economic and Community Development. She's going to stop by our studios for an update on the state's economy and manufacturing workforce, plus a conversation with Goodwin College President Mark Scheinberg. How is the school training the next generation of manufacturing employees? You can learn about that and join the conversation on Thursday. Now, has Connecticut lost its clean energy edge? A recent story in the Connecticut Mirror explores that question. I want to welcome to the show on the phone now Jan Ellen Spiegel, a reporter who covers energy, environment, and climate for the Connecticut Mirror. Jan, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
A very in-depth piece, a very extensive and important story that you've reported on recently for the Connecticut Mirror. You look at this question that Connecticut was once a leader in clean energy projects, and that's no longer the case. What happened?
Well, a lot of people point to a lot of different things concerning what might have happened. A lot of the focus is on the current budget situation. But I think you have to take a little bit of a look back to where we started. And where we started was in 2011 with the beginning of the Malloy administration. What happened at that time is the old Department of Environmental Protection was completely remade into the new Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, DEEP, that we know of now. And along with that reimagination came a dozen or more major programs that helped put clean energy into the mix and pushed it forward tremendously. Things like a whole new way of doing commercial, low and clean energy projects. The Green Bank was formed at that time as a way to leverage ratepayer money into more money that would enable more to be done in terms of clean energy programs, especially the residential solar program. There was a program called Lead by Example, which was going to help state buildings revamp their energy efficiency and thereby save money. And at the same time, we had some very, very ambitious environmental goals. We had the Global Warming Solutions Act, which required greenhouse gases be reduced 80% below 2001 standards by 2050. And we had a requirement for a certain amount of clean energy being purchased, renewable energy mm-hmm. being purchased, 20% by 2020. And those things got underway. In the meantime, other states in the region began to catch up with us. And that's kind of where we are today. New York has far surpassed us in terms of the types of programs they've put into effect and the types of really interesting initiatives that they've masterminded. Massachusetts mm-hmm. has taken the initiative across all kinds of things,
including offshore wind. Yeah.
And we are not, we're not quite there anymore. If you look at a recent chart done by Acadia Center, which is a environmental group in the Northeast, they've run through close to two dozen topics, and in only one of them is Connecticut still a leader, and that has to do with electric vehicle incentives. Everything else we've been surpassed on.
Now, Jan, how much of the budget problems, the consistent budget deficits year after year since 2011, how has that impacted Connecticut's goals for clean energy projects, letting these other New England states surpass what we've been doing?
Well, it depends on how you look at it. Some people feel that money should be spent on very, very pointed human service type programs, feeding people, getting health care to people, those sorts of things. But other folks look at the money that has been taken from clean energy, renewable energy, energy efficiency programs, and that happened tens and hundreds of millions of dollars worth were taken out in the last budget as essentially, I heard someone use the term before, cutting off our nose to spite our face. We're not, that money was being used for programs that in their process many people feel were also creating jobs, creating industries that would help the budget picture, as well as providing human service type support to folks who now no longer could get it. Let me give you an example. If you are a low-income person in Connecticut and you have trouble, say, paying your electric bill, there are energy efficiency programs, solar programs that are geared to helping you do something about that and lowering your energy bills. Without the without the funding that's now been taken away, you will no longer have that opportunity or have less of an opportunity to do that. So instead of accessing funds to help you with your overall energy bill, you may now need to access some other type of federal funds, state funds, to help you pay for your heat or pay for something else. So it becomes a false equivalent, some people feel, if you're looking at the budget situation as having an impact on the energy situation. Where do you draw that line? I think that's an interesting question to be looked at.
Now, the General Assembly has an Energy and Technology Committee. What is their role in informing their colleagues about the importance of these programs, the importance of this investment that will have long-term return?
Well, I mean, and you've just said it, long-term return. These folks need to think through some very, very complicated policies and some very, very complicated technology. And they have to think out many steps like a chess player would. There are those who believe the Energy and Technology Committee has not done a good job of informing people, even their own members, about how these interconnections in the energy world work, and that if you don't pay now, you're probably going to pay later. And they've come under a certain amount of fire on this. As a result, there has been a renewed effort to do a little bit more education among legislators broadly to explain how taking the ratepayer funds that were taken in this last session away from the, in particular, two entities that use them and using them to plug budget holes is essentially taking away your ability to help people save money, move into a clean energy sector, which in the long run will save them even more money and will help the state in terms of its climate goals and potentially help the state create businesses out of what they were doing as part of the energy initiatives. let's be clear. It's complicated. And there have been, in addition to the budget diversion here, has been the Millstone diversion. Mm-hmm. We've now spent a couple of years debating whether we should in some way incentivize Millstone, the nuclear power plant, to stay in business. And that has sucked a lot of energy out of the room, pardon the pun here. And there is an agreement now to potentially let Millstone participate with other clean energy sources to bid for an energy contract. Whether that will solve the problem, whether that will tamp down that diversion, we'll have to see. Potentially it won't.
Jen Allen Spiegel's reporter who covers energy, environment, and climate for the Connecticut Mirror. We're talking with her today after her in-depth story about the future of clean energy projects in Connecticut. Connecticut once being a leader, not so much now. Other states surpassing us in terms of the kinds of investment they're putting towards clean energy. Jan, we just have a couple more minutes. Something that people have been waiting for is this long overdue report, this clean energy strategy. When's that coming out? What's going to be in it?
Well, the Comprehensive Energy Strategy was first done, very first one was in 2013. It set forth a blueprint for the future. At that time, it was very much focused on conversion to natural gas. That elicited a huge outcry from the environmental community that we were going to get too invested in natural gas and not really move over to the truly clean energy sources. In the end, a lot of that conversion didn't happen, partly because the prices of oil plunged so dramatically that natural gas was no longer so much cheaper. This time, the energy strategy was supposed to be revised 3 years later. It was supposed to have been available to legislators a year and a half ago. There was a draft put out late last year, and we are awaiting in the next couple of weeks the latest incarnation of that. The draft had already gotten environmentalists a little bit upset because the draft had sought to cap solar power on individual homes. It's my understanding that that cap will be gone. There was enough of outrage over that cap will be gone, and there will continue to be an emphasis on solar power for individual homes, as well as solar power that goes directly into the grid. There is also likely to be a more stringent, more aggressive push for renewable energy that is recently based on the Governor's Council for Climate Change put in place an interim target for greenhouse gas emissions. They need to be reduced by 45% in 2030. That's a pretty steep climb. So the use of renewable power will have to somehow mirror that. One of the other things that's happened in the last couple of years is this push for offshore wind. And there are vast tracts, something like 630,000 acres already leased off New York and New England. Connecticut has the potential to buy into that wind. Some see this as a very, very important move on behalf of Connecticut because it will help them get into the onshore, offshore wind game. That is to say, provide staging areas, provide manufacturing, provide the kinds of business backbone that an offshore wind will need in the region. And there's a pretty big clamor that Connecticut needs to get on board with this pretty quickly if they want to capture a piece of the industry that will help build the economy.
Jan, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. It's a very complicated but in-depth story that you did. We're going to tweet it out at Where We Live. Also, link it on our website. But I want to thank Jan Allen Spiegel again, a reporter who covers energy, environment, and climate for the Connecticut Mirror. Thanks for your perspective.
Happy to be here.
Carmen Baskoff produced today's show. Special thanks to technical producer Kyone Wolf and senior producer Lydia Brown. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Thanks for listening.